Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. Although it may not sound like me because I've lost my voice, as you can probably hear. Apologies, listeners. This is going to be a much huskier episode than normal. But it's also somewhat appropriate that I've lost my voice because this is the very week that we have a virus expert on the show. And I'm pretty sure a virus is responsible for this. Yes, joining me today is Dr. Sarah Waters from the UCL Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health. Sarah started her career as a diagnostic virologist, identifying viruses in patients' blood, before specialising in HIV and joining a global project investigating HIV markers in children. Welcome, Sarah.
Good morning, Matilda.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well. I'm sorry to hear that one of my favourite microorganisms has infected you.
Oh, thank you.
We get such a bad rap.
Yeah, so why viruses? What do you find so interesting about them?
So I initially became obsessed with viruses, which are essentially just little pieces of nucleic acid. You know, they're very simplistic.
And nucleic acid, that, just for anyone listening at home, that's the same stuff our DNA is made of, right?
Yep, exactly. So they can be either DNA viruses or RNA viruses, which is
half a DNA.
Which is exactly half a DNA. So they're really, really simplistic, and they completely rely on a host to replicate themselves. But I actually became fascinated by viruses in the first year of my undergraduate at Nottingham University when I read the book Hot Zone by Richard Preston. And I don't know whether you've heard of that.
No.
So it's this amazing non-fiction book about Ebola and Marburg. And
oh, wow.
It's got this really graphic opening chapter. And I was just like obsessed. Like became really addicted to it. This, like the fact that this tiny little virus that is like just, again, like really, really simplistic could basically make someone, you know, bleed from their eyes and, you know, have all their blood come out of there.
When you put it like that, it's so true. Like it's not even a living thing and it can cause so much destruction.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that's kind of, a bit of a macabre way of kind of getting into virology. But actually, this turns out quite a common story. When I speak to my friends who are also virologists, they're all like, oh, yeah, Richard Preston, The Hot Zone. I recommended reading.
Also in the studio today, we have producer Kira, and she has not one but two brain teasers this week, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. So the first brain teaser is, why does HIV drive a 1956 Thunderbird? And the second one is, an infectious disease enters a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve your kind in here. So what is the virus's response? And you can tweet those at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio.
Also for our experiment today, Sarah is going to be showing us how to visualise the common cold as it spreads and to find out if you've been infected with it. All you need if you want to take part at home is access to some glitter. Is that right?
Glitter and some... I like to also use alcohol hand gel.
Oh,
so
yes.
If you've got some of that, alcohol hand gel, which will help you to not get the common cold virus and also help the glitter to stick onto your hands. So it's got twofold.
Brilliant.
Use.
Get access to those. Now, Sarah, it's your mixtape today. What is your first song and why?
So my first song today is One Vision by Queen. And I've chosen that because I'm going to talk a bit later about collaboration, and I work within a really large collaboration. We all have one vision.
One vision, one flesh, one bone, one true religion, one voice.
HIV continues to be a major global public health issue, with 36.7 million people worldwide currently infected with the virus. Sub-Saharan Africa is the worst affected area.
It's crazy how global that virus has managed to get. I mean, one going for world domination, the HIV virus certainly is one of those.
Yeah, so it's very successful.
Please tell me more about your project. And so you're working on a global project that is looking at markers of HIV in children. Yeah, tell me more.
So I work on a project called EPICAL, and I've got a bit of paper here to remind me what that stands for, because it just rolls off the tongue. So it's Early Treated Perinatally HIV-Infected Individuals, Improving Children's Actual Life with Novel Immunotherapeutic Strategies. Or EPICAL. So I just say...
I'm going to say EPICAL. Wow.
So I've been working on this for about a year and a half, and I still haven't managed to learn the acronym off by heart. But basically, it's a study... So there's 27 institutional partners across 12 countries. So we're a really large consortium.
Yeah, that is global.
It's
wow.
Really global. And we're working on... So it's children infected with HIV. So that's something that we don't tend to think about so much in the UK, because in the UK and Europe, we have maybe one child born with HIV a year. The rate is really, really low. However, globally, there's 3 to 4 million children are infected with HIV, living with HIV.
I had no idea.
And about 90% of those are in sub-Saharan Africa, like Kira said.
Yep.
And there's around 200,000, 250,000 children are born with HIV every year still. So it's something that we don't think about so much in this country, because it's no longer really an issue here because of the advances in antiretroviral therapy, which is the anti-HIV drug.
So if a mother is pregnant and on the anti-HIV drug, will it pass on to her child or no?
No.
So it's only when it's actually... in your blood that it can pass on?
Yes. Yeah, and even then it's not always, it's not 100%.
Okay.
Likely to, but yeah. So if you're on antiretroviral therapy and your virus is, we say that your virus is suppressed, so you don't have virus in your blood, then you won't pass the virus on to your baby. And equally, you are very unlikely to pass the virus on to your sexual partner.
Okay.
So the advances in antiretroviral therapy now are
I didn't think I realised how effective it was.
Really, really
effective. I thought it just kind of controlled the symptoms and you know, stopped you from developing AIDS.
Yeah, because HIV doesn't necessarily have symptoms. So you have a syndrome when you're first infected, but not everyone has that. And it's like a flu-like illness, like a, you know...
Yeah,
probably,
if you get it in winter, how would you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
everyone has flu in winter.
And then you develop symptoms... after you've been infected for a number of years, if you weren't on antiretroviral therapy, and those symptoms are to do with your with you becoming immunosuppressed, so loss of your immune system, and you catch unusual infections
that normally you would fight off.
Exactly. So so why we're interested in children and children who are born to HIV infected mothers, so that's called mother to child transmission.
Yeah. So the mother has HIV and she's not on the retrograde drugs, yeah. So she passes it on to her child.
Yeah. And she, so actually in the last kind of decade, there's been a 50% decrease in the number of children being born to HIV positive mothers. So
wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah,
which is brilliant. And that's all to do with initiatives that have come about to do with, so getting mums on antiretroviral therapy, encouraging bottle feeding, and which isn't always possible, because in some countries, you know, breast milk is really important for preventing a number of other infections.
Yeah, because it's hard to get the clean water for the...
Exactly, yeah. So for like rotavirus and things, yeah. Other infections.
And there's lots of immune cells in the exactly. breast milk
antibodies.
As well.
Yeah. So it's kind of...
A balance.
A balance. Also in some countries that you can have a C-section. So, but actually the main driver is getting mums on antiretroviral therapy. So they have to be diagnosed is the first step, and then they have to go on antiretroviral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all fantastic, okay? But we still have to remember that, you know, globally this is still a problem. And so what's happening now is there is a big drive to diagnose children early and get them on the antiretroviral therapy, the HIV medication, as early as possible. And that is actually becoming very successful now. So in South Africa, that's really, you know, their rates of children born with HIV, infants born with HIV are dropping, and they're
they're starting children on antiretroviral therapy really early. So this is all fantastic. So the next phase then is to identify, so to find the children who've started antiretroviral therapy early. And we know that these children then have, so we call this the HIV reservoir. Mm-hmm. So that's the amount of HIV that you have within your body that is within cells.
So it's in your cells, not your blood?
In your cells, not in your blood. So part of the HIV life cycle is actually the virus will integrate into your genome and then hide there.
So it literally embeds into the DNA within your cells?
Yeah. And then it hangs out there, which is why you can't cure HIV. Mm.
Yeah, because right? Your body won't know. There's nothing in our body that like scans the DNA within our nuclei.
Yeah, and it's so if those cells are then resting or asleep, then the virus is also resting and asleep. And it's only when the cell becomes activated that the virus becomes activated, and then the cells are
there particular
targeted.
Cells that they like to hide in?
Yeah, so they're called the CD4 T cells. So they're white blood cells.
Uh-huh, okay.
So they hang out there.
So they hide in the immune system. It's exactly. Very brazen of them.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very brazen.
Hey, you're coming to kill me. Let me just hide inside you.
Exactly. So we know that... So children who start antiretroviral therapy early have smaller reservoirs.
Because you've got this virus out of their blood before that many could hide in the
exactly.
cells.
Exactly, so okay. Before that reservoir could kind of expand. And so what we're interested in is what in certain children will have smaller reservoirs and maybe have markers in their immune system which are better at fighting HIV. And we don't know yet exactly what all those different markers are, viral markers and immune markers. So part of this study is to work together to create a huge data set of children and babies. So it's mainly babies, actually, infants who start antiretroviral therapy early. We're collecting blood samples and looking at viral and immune markers over time and trying to identify, okay, that child's doing really well, why? So right. Find the markers and then try and work out why they've done well. And then the next step is then to put that into practice and develop some kind of vaccine or therapeutic strategy to try and get the children in a place where they don't need to be on antiretroviral therapy continuously. So we no longer really talk about HIV cure, we talk about HIV remission, which I think we're going to talk about a bit later as well.
Fantastic.
So that's kind of... What the aim is, and it's because you know if you're a baby born with HIV, you have to take antiretroviral drugs for your entire life.
Yeah,
and that has issues. You know, there are short and long-term toxicity issues. You also, if you aren't adherent, if you don't take them every single day, then the virus can mutate, and then the drugs don't work anymore.
Right.
So it's trying to get people it's to really a tricky. Point where you don't have to take a drug every day.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah. So there's all different strategies at the moment, like long acting.
But like you said, we're going to talk about those in a bit. Take me to your second
too
song.
Too excited. So my second choice is actually Africa by Toto.
And why have you chosen this one?
And I've chosen this because I've recently come back from a really long trip to South Africa and Mozambique and Malawi, where I was visiting the sites that are in working within our studies. And basically my job is to make sure that all of the sites are collecting samples and are processing samples and running experiments in the same way. So I was going around all the different sites and meeting all the lab scientists, and we were meeting the clinical staff, and I was with my colleague Alfredo, who was on the clinical side, and we were meeting everyone and checking if it was going to work. Before one of our studies initiates.
Amazing.
So
it's very important.
We had this fantasy that we were going to create a music video for Africa and it didn't happen. So we'll play the song now.
I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, hurry boy, it's waiting there for you. Gotta take the life to drag me away from you. There's nothing that 100 men or more could ever do. I bless the rains down
HIV infection is often diagnosed through rapid diagnostic tests, which detect the presence or absence of HIV antibodies. Most often these tests provide same-day results, which are essential for same-day diagnosis and early treatment and care.
So we are at the experiment part of the show, and I'm really excited. I can see glitter in front of me. I can see lots of very technical looking kind of medical things. We've got that alcoholic gel. We've got some drops. We've got some syringes. And Sarah's even put on a wonderful pink lab coat. I mean, looks amazing. So what are we preparing to do?
So we're going to use glitter as an example of a germ or a virus. So I'm just putting some alcohol gel onto my hands and putting some glitter on my oversized tub of glitter.
So what is this virus? Is it just a glitter germ? Does it have a name?
So this is the glitter virus, or the glitterus.
The glitterus.
The glitterus. So as you can see on my hands, the glitter basically looks like lots and lots and lots of little tiny viruses. If viruses were visible with the naked eye.
Yeah, so lots of tiny particles of glitter.
Tiny, tiny particles. So I'm clearly infected with the glitter.
I can see that you're infected, yes.
Right? And so I can spread this to you by touching you.
Okay,
nice
so
to meet you.
Shaking hands.
Hi. And oh, now you're infected.
You've actually put quite a lot of glitter on my hand.
So.
Okay, so now I'm infected.
You're infected. And you could also get infected by touching areas that I've also touched. And then if I was to sneeze, I'm not sure if this will work. So the glitter germ flies through the air.
Yeah, so Sarah just literally kind of sneezed into her hands, which had glitter all over them, and it literally blew onto my face. And also when she touched the newspaper and I touched the newspaper, I got glitter on me. That is a really good model, I think, of how you can just... Because I never think about that. I think about if someone sneezes in my face, yes, then I'll be like, oh, they're clearly ill. Mm. But I never think about if I've shaken someone's hand or if I've, you know, touched a handrail that maybe someone who's ill has touched.
Yeah, especially with the cold virus or our glitterous here. I mean, it's, you know, you end up with a lot of cold virus particles on surfaces, and they're called fomites. And so they're actually really resistant. So if you touch a door handle that someone else has touched after they've blown their nose or like wiped their eyes, and you touch it and then you wipe your eyes or your nose, then you transmit the virus to yourself.
Oh wow. I'm gonna try and not touch anything that you guys are touching today. Actually, you probably don't want to touch anything I'm touching.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly
the one that's got an illness. But there's lots of ways that viruses can spread, right? So the cold one is very, like you said, very resistant. What are some other ways? We know HIV spreads through bodily fluids.
Yes, so HIV spreads through, it's not all body fluids, it's mainly through blood, but it's also transmitted sexually. And so good examples are, so direct spread. So that's person-to-person contact, sexual contact, kissing, these kind of things. So that's different viruses and colds and bacteria can spread that way. And then there's indirect spread. So that's like fecal oral. So that would be food poisoning or eating contaminated food or drinking contaminated water. Or the example where basically you just touched the paper that I touched and you got something there.
That would be indirect.
Then we have zoonoses. So that's animal spread. So a good example of that is rabies. Which
yes,
you can
of
get
course,
from
when you get
animals.
When the dog bites you, yes.
Yeah, or scratches you. And then we also have vector-borne, so that's like malaria or Zika, chikungunya. So that's when you're basically bitten by a mosquito or a
mosquito is the vector.
And
yes.
Exactly, is a vector. So there's many different ways that you can be infected with something. Yes. It's not, I suppose this podcast isn't very good for germophobes.
I should have given a warning at the top.
Yeah.
And so you talked in the first half about, you know, testing people's blood and, you know, testing people for HIV. How do you do that? What's the HIV test involve?
So there are multiple ways that you can test for HIV. So the two main ways are that you'll have an antibody test. So that is basically looking to see whether you have, your body has developed antibodies against HIV. We have tests that will detect that. And then we also look for something called antigen. So that's a part of the virus. And we will look for that in your blood. So both of those, the antibody and antigen tests, are called immunoassays. And we're going to do a small example of that in a minute.
Okay, fantastic.
But the other ways of looking for HIV are looking for their nucleic acids, so their RNA and DNA. So we're going to do a little immunoassay now, a point-of-care test. And the reason we're going to do this is because even though you look like you're infected with the glycerus, I mean, we don't know that you're infected with the glycerus and not another kind of sparkly virus.
That's true. Right? It could be another sparkly virus.
It could be anything. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to swab you.
Okay.
And I'm going to swab your mouth, the back of your throat. Okay, thank you very much. Right, then I'm going to... Probably should have opened this before.
So Sarah's just unwrapping a little kind of mini pipette-type plastic bottle. And the swab that she used in my mouth was basically like a giant cotton bud on a really long stick. And now she's just rubbed the end of that cotton bud into a fluid that was in the little plastic pipette pot.
And this fluid now contains your throat swab. And it also contains something called a conjugate. So what the conjugate is... It is an antibody to the glitter virus, and that antibody is coupled to an enzyme. What should happen is the antibody that's coupled to an enzyme will attach to the antigen, which is the glitter virus. And the enzyme is there because it causes a colour change later on.
So, okay, so you're using the antibody. The antibody's going to find the virus if I've got it in my throat swab.
Yeah.
It's going to attach to it, and then because it's got an enzyme on it, it will change colour in your reaction and you'll be able to see it.
Exactly. I'm really regretting now the
glitter everywhere.
So what I've got here is a little point of care test, and this is called a lateral flow device. There is some filter paper in the middle, and that filter paper is actually, there are three lines in there which you can't see, and those lines are embedded with antibodies.
Uh-huh.
The first line, antibodies against the glycerus. The middle line against the control, which is that enzyme that I mentioned that will cause the colour change later. And the third line is against the toxin that the glycerus produces.
Great.
So I've added your swab and the diluent there. Now we have to wait a little while.
Okay, so while we're waiting, this is the perfect time, Sarah. Tell me your third song and why.
So I mentioned that another way of looking for HIV is looking for its nucleic acid. And so we look for either the RNA, which is the actual virus that's in your bloodstream, and that's called a viral load. And or we look for the HIV DNA, and that's the virus when it's hiding within your cells. And the way we look for those nucleic acids is by using a test called PCR, which is the polymerase chain reaction. So the next song I've chosen is by the company Bio-Rad. Other PCR machines are available. And Bio-Rad created this amazing song in 2009 called the PCR song, and it will explain to you what PCR is.
There was a time when the amplified DNA, you had to grow tons and tons of tiny cells. Ooh, and along came again if Dr. Carey said you can amplify in vitro just as well. Just mix your tablet with a buffer and some primer. Nucleotides and polymerases too. Denaturing and annealing and extending. Well, it's amazing what heating and cooling and heating will do.
HIV attacks and destroys the infection-fighting cells of the immune system. This makes the body much more susceptible to infections and certain cancers.
So, we've given it quite a few minutes. Have we got our result?
So, if you look here, you can see that one of the lines is appearing already. So, that is the line for the glycerus toxin. So, I'm afraid you have been infected.
I have been infected.
Oh no, infected.
Do we have a cure or do I just have to wait for it to pass?
You just have to wait for the glitter to slowly fall off. But as we all know,
that could take a long time.
It could take years. But you will find glitter on your face for the next month, probably. And I'm really sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you for diagnosing me correctly.
So you can have that on top of your cold.
Two viruses now. So I know that you worked in a lab for a long time doing exactly this, diagnosing when patients got blood tests, it would go to your lab and you would look and see if they actually had the virus in their blood and send it back. So what got you to move from that into HIV? Because is it true that you didn't actually even want to study HIV originally?
That is true. I never wanted to work on HIV. I wanted to work on respiratory viruses. That was my passion. I was really obsessed with respiratory viruses and how quickly they cause like these big outbreaks and how they can make people feel so miserable. Right?
Yeah.
Horrible. And they're really effective spreaders. But I used to be something called a clinical scientist. So we work in the diagnostic lab in the NHS, and we're kind of between the technical staff and the doctors. And as part of that, I did a research project. And the research project that came to me was we had a chap turn up in the hospital who had multiple myeloma, which is a type of cancer of the blood.
Uh-huh.
And he was going to get a transplant for that, a bone marrow transplant. And prior to his bone marrow transplant, he had a HIV test. So when you're going for a transplant, you have a lot of tests done to see what viruses you've got before, you know, the doctors take away your immune system.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it turned out he was HIV positive.
Did he know that he was HIV positive, or this was new information?
This was new information. So he was HIV positive, but what was interesting about him was that he had antibodies to HIV, which we found by doing the immunoassay, and he had HIV DNA, which is the HIV when it's hiding within your cells.
Yeah.
But we couldn't find any HIV in his blood, so any HIV RNA. So HIV is an RNA virus, so you'd expect to find it.
And RNA is just half of DNA.
Yeah. It's half of DNA, exactly. And so why that's really, really unusual. And why that is because if you're not on antiretroviral therapy, if you're not on the anti-HIV drugs, then you should have many, many, many copies of HIV RNA
floating around in your blood.
You should be able to find them. And so we suspected that he might be something called a HIV elite controller. So these people represent about less than 1% of HIV positive
population.
And because, so this HIV diagnosis came at a bit of a tricky time where he was undergoing a transplant, he was having complications because of his multiple myeloma. So HIV clinically was kind of low down the list. So he was not put on antiretroviral therapy. So we continued to monitor him. And what happened was, once his immune system was wiped out because of the bone marrow transplant.
Yeah, because whenever you have a transplant, you have to suppress the immune system so your body doesn't reject the new bone you're putting in, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So his immune system was suppressed on purpose. And then the virus rebounded. So we say rebounded because we assume it must have been there at some point. So it came up.
It was definitely his own immune system that was controlling it.
Yes. And we...
I didn't even know that was possible in anyone.
It's really, really cool. And then what was even cooler then about this guy was that within about 40 days, he still wasn't given any anti-HIV drugs. He then suppressed the virus. His own immune system did it.
Wow, amazing.
So then I was...
You need to bottle that. Whatever he's got.
So then I was converted. So I was like, okay, fine.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
New passion.
Yeah. So, but one of the reasons why I didn't want to work on HIV originally is because it's a very competitive field as well. But I was really hooked. And for me, I've always really liked that sweet spot, the interface between clinical medicine and like bench work, basic science, so translational research. So really enjoyed it. And then I went on and did my PhD looking at people who have cancers and undergo chemotherapy and also have HIV.
What did you find?
a lot.
Which is good. Story of science.
Which is good.
So if you have HIV and you have cancer, then the chemotherapy drugs, you know, it's perfectly safe.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah, good to know.
How close do you think there will ever be a time where we're able to actually fully cure HIV? Is that possible?
No, I think that now we've kind of accepted that we won't be able to cure HIV.
Why is that?
Just because of what I was saying about HIV
hiding
within the cells. So we know there have been a few examples now of patients who have had cancers and have been given bone marrow transplants, and it's looked like the HIV has been cured. But once they stop the antiretroviral therapy, once they stop the HIV medication, the virus comes back. And so you... Even though we can't find the virus, and that's because our tests aren't sensitive enough yet. So you only need one of these cells to be infected to carry a HIV for it to come back. So what the aim now is to aim for a remission. So similar to cancer remission.
Yeah.
So an extended period of time where you don't have to take HIV medication. And so that's kind of the goal now.
Amazing.
Which would still be amazing.
Yeah. And life-changing for those that do have it.
Yeah.
What is song number four?
So song number four is I Am Woman by Hen and Reddy. So I really, really love this song. It's about empowerment and women. I am woman, hear me roar.
Excellent.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore. And I know too much to go back and pretend, 'cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa, yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom all the pain if I pay the price. But look how much I gained.
So as Sarah said already, viruses are not alive. They are inanimate, complex, organic matter. They lack any form of energy or carbon metabolism and can only reproduce and evolve within a host.
Science!
News!
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 News just in. The world pays tribute to Stephen Hawking. R.I.P.
False news on the Twitter sphere tends to spread faster than true facts.
Scientists have developed vegan dog food.
Plastic particles found in bottled water.
Alcohol overuse is an important contributory risk factor for dementia.
There's a new Aurora, and its name is Steve.
Well, I think we have to start with R.I.P. Stephen Hawking.
Yeah. Very sad.
So I have a couple of quotes by Stephen Hawking. So the first one is, the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it is the illusion of knowledge, which I really liked.
I really like that. Yeah.
I think a lot of people suffer.
when you think you know it all and you don't realise what you don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
That can be a dangerous position. I love quotes. What are the others?
The other one is intelligence is the ability to adapt and to change.
I would agree with that. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And he certainly had
like
to
viruses.
Adapt like, in his life, didn't he? Yeah. I didn't realise until I watched the film they made with Eddie Redmayne, like the biopic. I didn't actually realise that he was originally told he was only going to have like a couple of years to live and how he just completely
defied
all of that expectation. Yeah. It was incredible.
Yeah,
what a boss.
Kira, tell me about the alcohol and dementia.
Yeah, so a massive study was carried out in France with, I think, over 1 million people with dementia. And they found that people with dementia had, like they were more likely to have an alcohol overuse problem earlier in life. And this was particularly important for early onset dementia people, like people who get dementia before the age of 65.
Wow.
So, but, you know, that's really important because that's completely avoidable. So
yeah, absolutely. It's a way of completely lowering that risk.
Yeah, exactly.
The AbFab generation are going to be worried. and I'm fascinated, Sarah, by this vegan dog food.
Yeah, so I guess this is taking kind of Veganuary a bit
to the
far.
Next level.
Yeah. So this is a company in California called Wild Earth, and who are encouraging people to turn their dogs vegan. So what they've done is they've created a vegan dog food using a strain of Aspergillus, which is also found in like soy sauce and miso soup and stuff. It's got that umami.
Is that a fungi?
It's a fungi.
So fun.
So they've basically got this bioreactor, and they're growing a lot of aspergillus in there. And they're saying that the final product looks a bit like tuna. Yeah. But interestingly, this is also how corn is made.
Corn, I love corn.
Me too. And corn is made with fusarium, I think. Another type of fungus. Yeah. So there's a bit of uproar about this at the moment, obviously, whether or not it's good for your dog to be vegan. Probably not recommended.
I think, it is interesting, because when people are vegetarian or vegan and they have pets, and it's like, oh, well, if you're being vegan for sort of all these kind of animal rights or environmental reasons or whatever, how can you justify then buying meat and feeding it to your pet? You should just not have a pet. And I think that is like quite a kind of controversial area, because then I think I heard someone on the radio say who was defending her position and saying, well, you know, my cat wasn't made to be an omnivore. Like he has to have meat in his diet and to get all the nutrients that he needs. And it's not my position to impose my own beliefs on my cat. But it is a tricky one. But
yeah, it's tricky.
At least there's another option now.
Yeah, there is another option. And I guess if we ever run out of dog food,
we could eat it ourselves.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what they were saying. They were saying that this vegan dog food can be enjoyed by dogs and their owners. I think I'll be giving it a miss. But
so the story I picked, plastic particles found in bottled water, I just really caught my eye because, firstly, I'm a big tap water drinker. I don't want to spend the money on buying bottled water unless I have to. And so this is kind of like, haha, to all these people who always claim that like plastic bottled water is better for you or, you know, more nutritious. I don't know. Some people would do fourth for the brand. Anyway, so this company they examined 250 bottles that had been bought in 9 different countries, all big brands like Evian, Dasani, Nestle and San Pellegrino, Aquafina. And they found on average there were 10 plastic particles per litre, each plastic particle about the width of a human hair. And there's no evidence at the moment that drinking those very small pieces of plastic is going to harm us, but it just is really kind of bringing that plastic conversation to the front, because the lady that ran it, Professor Mason, last year found plastic particles in tap water as well, so ha-ha me, and seafood and beer and sea salt and even the air. And plastic is just, these tiny particles are getting everywhere.
It still has to go through your digestive tract, and how easily is that going to be absorbed
it might not harm us, but just the fact that it's managed to be there, I think just shows how pervasive our plastic waste has become. All of these tiny plastic particles are literally everywhere in the world, and they have been shown to be harmful to other animals, fish and things.
And it's your passing it, you know, you're not absorbing it into your body, but then you're passing it back into the environment, so it's another build-up of
it's just
plastic.
Gone
But alongside that article, I then saw one, just a headline where the Green Alliance group was saying our war on plastics could actually be worse for the environment before it makes things better, because they're worried that if you swap all the plastic packaging for plant packaging, you're going to increase deforestation and also increase food waste. And at the moment, agriculture is a really big producer of carbon gases, or greenhouse gases. So limiting food waste is important as well. So I just like that, because I'm very much like plastic waste is bad, and it made me think a little bit that it's a bit more complicated than I first thought.
Yes, it's all these contributing factors into every decision that's made without us realizing.
Tell me about your toy sphere.
So scientists at MIT created these robots to send out fake news and also real news, but they found that the fake news traveled like 70% faster than the real news because it was more novel and more interesting, I guess, and people are more likely to retweet.
Yeah, clickbait, things. Right? Everyone wants something a bit outrageous.
Exactly, but it's kind of worrying.
But not surprising.
And we have one final science mixtape piece of news, and that is Kira has upgraded her PhD. So huge congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you.
Would you like to give
halfway
a quick...
there.
Yeah. Living on a prayer. Would you like to give a quick summary to listeners what you are studying in your PhD?
So I work in the same institute as Sarah. So I'm in the UCL Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health. And my focus is on also the immune system, but in particular autoinflammatory conditions, and so mainly children who are born with these conditions because of a genetic component. And it's like some of the diseases that they have are really horrible. It's mainly brain inflammation. Oh. So they have these like horrible lesions in their brain, and there was a 9-year-old girl in particular that is on my study, and she couldn't walk or talk. When she had flares, she could walk remissive.
It's not there all the time.
It's not there all the time, but it kind of comes and goes in flares.
And she loses all that function when
it does. Yeah, it's really, really horrible.
So
but I found a gene and they have her on some medicine now and it's helping. So that's really good.
I mean, that's amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Right? And it's kind of what I was talking about earlier. It's that sweet spot, the translational medicine.
Yeah.
Bench to bedside.
Exactly.
You can really see the effects.
Impact of it. Yeah.
So the work that Kira's done has then directly had patient impact
benefit. Life, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Huge congratulations.
Thanks.
Sarah, song five.
So song five is Any Way You Want It by Journey, just because.
Why not?
She loves to laugh, she loves to sing, she does everything. She loves to move, she loves to groove, she loves a lot of things. Oh, all night, all night, oh, every night. So hold tight, hold tight. Ooh, baby, hold tight.
Between 2000 and 2016, new HIV infections fell by 39%, and HIV-related deaths fell by one-third, and 13.1 million lives saved due to antiretroviral therapy during that period.
It's incredible. Amazing.
It's quite impressive.
Incredible, the advances people have made. So Sarah, for this last part, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the challenges of working in such a global project, because I think I was a science teacher for a couple of years, and It was something that we taught at school, that scientists have to collaborate, but I don't remember ever it being taught to me myself. Mm. I just wondered how you find it.
Yeah, so I mean, I love it. I love working in a big collaboration and meeting lots of different people. And it's something that is 100% essential now in modern day science. I think the days of lone scientists working alone in biology are kind of over. You can't really do that anymore.
Can't lock yourself away like Isaac Newton. And
no, I mean, you can, but in order to like achieve, you know, to collect big data and make progress, you really do need to collaborate and work together. However, that comes with challenges. So like I said, EPICAL is now so it's 27 partner institutions, 12 countries, 4 continents.
Amazing.
So we have a lot of teleconferences and emails. And so one of the first kind of problems with that is that teleconferences kind of don't work. And I don't know if you've ever sat on a teleconference. So the first thing that happens, so if you have a teleconference and everyone's in the same country, the first thing that happens is you always get one person or two people that like to talk more than the others.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, you kind of get
some dominant speakers.
So that's the first problem. Then if you kind of then move that, so it's like a global teleconference, you then have problems with connectivity and kind of, you know, a lot of people on the call, English isn't their first language. So you have a problem maybe with misunderstanding what people are saying. And that comes from not being able to see people's faces. Right. So we kind of forget how much of, communication, interaction with people is actually based on looking for people's reactions to what you're saying.
Yeah.
So quite often in a teleconference, for example, I'll go, so what do you think about that? And then it'll just be silent.
And they're thinking, but you can't see.
And tumbleweed, it's going. And you have no idea if people have fallen asleep, if they're really engaged, or if they weren't paying, you don't really know what's going on, or if they haven't understood what you've said. So
it's a bit like radio. You're just in a room speaking into the ether, getting nothing.
Hoping for the best. So what we found actually is, I suppose it's not rocket science, that it makes perfect sense, but you kind of, when we meet up with each other, we achieve so much in a really small amount of time. So for example, so we went all the way to South Africa and Mozambique, and we spent like a day and a half with each site. But actually within the first hour or 2 hours, we'd achieved everything. We needed to be there for that long, if anyone's listening who is in charge. But in the first kind of hour and a half,
you'd made incredible progress
just by being able to see and really interact with each other,
just communicate efficiently.
Yeah. And I've heard stories of people going to have meetings in airports, just for a 4-hour meeting in an airport, because it's much more productive than trying to have a teleconference.
Wow.
So teleconferences, I think, just, they are great. They really don't work. But we have, there's obviously Skype, but there's other programs now like Zoom. So it is better to try and have a video call, but then you can't have a video call with
more than like 3 or 4 people.
No, exactly. That doesn't work either. So, that's one of the main, that is a big issue, I think, with collaborations. It's the communication side.
And coordinating people is actually quite a large part of your particular role, isn't it?
Yeah, so coordinating people and getting people to, so the main part of my job is to get everyone to kind of do the same thing, and to get everyone to kind of work together. And I think an example I gave you before was it's the equivalent of trying to get your mates together on a night out. But it seems like a really straightforward thing that you can do. Let's meet up, but first of all, okay, you can't agree on the time, and then you can't agree on the place, and then there's always like different personalities, so
and then someone's texting you on the side, what are you gonna wear?
Exactly. And that happens as well in teleconferences. People will talk,
they're just like
the teleconference. So then you've got that going on. Yeah. So there's like the different levels of things going on within the collaboration. So, it's quite difficult, but it's so important. So you just kind of have to work with those challenges, be aware that there's multiple personalities. Everyone wants to be involved. Everyone wants to have a role, and, be aware that people have different expertise. And so, I only know about viruses. So there's no way that I'm going to write a protocol or tell an immunologist what to do. I'm going to ask them what to do. So it's all about, knowing that. Knowing your weaknesses and working within it, but
and making sure that it's about looking at the resources across the whole project and making it as efficient as possible.
Yes, exactly. And also knowing that some labs maybe have more expertise, so they should definitely be the ones doing it. And when it's appropriate for every lab to do a little piece, and when it's appropriate for one lab to just take the lead. And that's all really, really difficult. It's a real balancing act. And you just, you have to do, at the end of the day, you have to do what's best for the samples and what's best for the project, and try and take some of the personal aspects out of it. But you can't do that completely, because that's the politics of collaboration science.
Yeah. We have a little feature on Science Mixtape called the Fieldwork Faux Pas.
Okay.
So that's any little stories where something's just not gone quite right in the field, because science doesn't always go perfectly. Have you got any examples, either from in the lab or from collaboration challenges, where things just haven't quite gone to plan, or you've said something really stupid? Or
So I have one example. And so it's not something that's led to any major catastrophes, but it's something that came out during the recent Africa trip. And that is that, so I work with a lot of European collaborators who all speak English as a second language, but their English is amazing. And I don't, you know, can't fault them because I can barely speak Italian. You know, I can barely speak English, if we're being honest, with my dodgy London accent. But yeah, so what came to light was that they can't understand me.
Oh!
So it turns out that all the Europeans that I work with who speak English as a second language can understand each other perfectly well, but they can't understand English speakers when they speak English. And it's not just me, they can't understand any of us. And I had no idea. So it might actually...
Do you find yourself adapting?
I find myself doing that really embarrassing thing where you start to copy people's accent or like or like awkwardly kind of slow down. Yeah. You know when you try to simplify your language, but you end up making no sense.
Yeah. But they understand you.
Well, I'm not sure they do now. And I think it really maybe explains those silences I was talking about on the teleconference. Right.
They're all there being like, what has she said? And what's your favourite thing about the work that you do?
I just love the... So what I love at the moment is the satisfaction of seeing a study get off the ground. So we... one thing that's happened during my time... So I've been working as a project for about a year and a half, and we started recruiting for one of the sub-studies, and that was a really big moment. I took a lot of selfies of my, you know, holding the samples when they arrived in the lab.
Very
I was really
essential.
Excited. I was like, yes. So that was great, you know, because that's worked. You know, you've put a process in place and you can see that it's starting to work. So that was great. Although that's, you know, very early on, we now need to get the data. But also it's been really... it's really great to get to work with so many different people from so many different backgrounds and hear people's experiences of working in the field of HIV. Because it's so global and everyone's experiences are really different, and especially in terms of you know, the healthcare situation that people are coming from and just people's backgrounds. So that's been really eye-opening.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Kira, yes. It's time.
The brain teasers. The answers.
So can you just read them again, just to remind our listeners?
Sure. Here? So why does HIV drive a 1956 Thunderbird? Any guesses in the studio?
I'm really focusing on like the Thunderbird aspect. I'm like, to make a banging entrance. It's terrible. I'm sure that's not the answer.
That's actually a pretty good guess, but it's actually because it's a retrovirus.
Oh, I should have focused on the age.
Well, we had really good guesses from everyone on Twitter, so thanks for that. And the other one was, an infectious disease enters a bar. The bartender says, "We don't serve your kind in here." So what do you think the infectious disease replied?
I'm not sure. This seems kind of like...
Did they kick off?
Yeah.
Kind of like,
was it like, what do you mean you don't serve our kind? What are you saying? So what, did it lead to a protest?
What is this? Racism?
Is it something like he needed to get some support from his friend AIDS? I don't know, like some aid? I don't know.
Oh, actually, that would have been good. But the answer actually is the infectious disease goes, well, you're not a very good host.
And on those hilarious notes, no, they were actually really good jokes. We've come to the end of our show. So thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely fascinating. I have learned so much about HIV. I didn't know half the stuff that you have talked about. So it's been really,
really
brilliant.
Good.
Thank you. I'm sorry that you're now infected with the glycerus and the cold virus. I'm also going to be picking this stuff out of my hair for the next month.
I think your infection is worse than mine. Yeah. And what is your final song to play us out?
So my final song, I thought, you know, go hard or go home. So I've chosen Don't Rain on My Parade by Barbra Streisand.
Bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it. Hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it. But whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die once. Right, sir. Ooh, life is juicy, juicy, and you see.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider.